You are listening to inspiring stories of ordinary people doing extraordinary stuff. Welcome to the Doolanders.
Hit it!
That's what I'm talking about.
Wait!
Okay, now, from the beginning.
Hit it, boys.
Welcome to the Doolanders. I am Blake Collins.
And unlike Blake, I'm Nick Devadas.
How are you, mate?
I'm great. This is episode 51.
We are back in business. Can you believe it's been, 6 months since our last recording?
It's amazing. And the amount of damage that has been done through COVID, through schools locking down, through the world opening up again. And here we are.
Yeah. Look, we've been inundated, bombarded with pleas and requests.
I can't walk down the street, Blake, without someone saying,
"Yep,
when's the next episode coming?"
That is absolutely nowhere near the truth, but we are back nonetheless. Mate, we're changing it up this year, aren't we?
Yep, we are. We're going to go with two different formats this year, Blake. Sorry to spring this on you.
Okay, let's go with it.
We're going with the original format, which is this one, episode 51.
Tried and true.
We're also introducing a new, whole new theme.
And what's that called?
It's going to be the Doolanders Health Quest.
Wow, what a name. Who came up with that?
I'm going to say me.
Yeah.
And one of my many cats.
Unbelievable. Just creativity at its best. So the Health Quest is going to be, what's it going to be?
Well, it's going to be shorter and sharper in our long format, and it's going to be all about health tips across mental health, physical health, nutrition, all of these sorts of things from some of the top people in the world. Just their advice for, all right, what do I need to do? So little bite-sized samples that you can go, all right, I don't know how to sleep. I'm going to listen to a sleep specialist. I'm going to listen to someone in nutrition or physical performance, something like that.
So what you're saying is bite-sized bits of brilliance for our listeners.
Say that three times quickly, Blake.
Bite-sized bits of brilliance. No, I can't. All right, should we get cracking into our first episode?
Well,
for 2022. And number 51 of the re-energized, revolutionized and revamped Doolanders.
Yeah, we should. And it is Fleur McDonald, who is an author slash farmer slash community driver, just an amazing woman who has done some incredible things, lived a different sort of life to a lot of other people, even in the farming community, and has managed to write so many books that are so popular. And we're really pleased that we were able to interview her in November of 2021 to try and launch her book, that we missed the target because of all the things we mentioned at the start of this episode.
Yep. Just sold the 700,000 copies, has Fleur. Amazing. She's an amazing woman. Here she is. Fleur McDonald, welcome to the Doolanders. How are you?
Thanks, Blake. Yes, I'm well today. It's been a really cold and windy day here in Esperance. So I've been tucked up inside doing some writing and a few little things like that. Cool day.
Well, we're on the other side of the country and here in Melbourne, and I reckon, Nick, what's it reached today?
Well, the feels like on the Bureau of Meteorology app is in the negatives, I think.
It's
not nearly a great day.
Nearly summer, it's absolutely freezing. Hey, Fleur, thank you so much for taking some time out of your day to spend some time with us. We always love to ask our guests, tell us, Fleur McDonald, who are you and what do you do?
Funny question. I really have no idea who I am. I grew up in a little town called Oru, and I grew up the daughter of a truckie who owned a fuel distributor business that covered about a quarter of Australia. So when I was little, Dad was still driving trucks, so I used to spend a bit of time in the truck with him and go north and west and, you know, meet loads of interesting characters up there. And Dad and I used to sing lots of songs in the trucks as we travelled along. And I think my week that I would spend away with Dad sort of gave Mum a bit of a break away from this very chatty little girl that I used to be. And I love reading, and so therefore I guess I learned how to structure a book subconsciously through reading, so that drew me into writing, which is, you know, what I do for a full-time job now. I spent about 25 years on a farm, learning how to farm, being a farmer, becoming a farm manager. And I've got two kids with disabilities. Not that you would know that my daughter has one now. She's doing really well. And Hayden he has autism. He's 20 and learning to fly a plane. So
that's unreal.
Going on with who we are.
Wow. There's a lot in all of that. And you know what, Fleur, I'm going to step back and I want to unpack some of that, right? So you said you grew up in this little dot of a town called Oruro, which from what I understand is on the main drag from Port Augusta right through to Sydney. And your family, so they ran it, was it a trucking company, a fuel depot and a trucking company?
Yeah, it was. It started back in the 1800s when my great-grandfather used to build sulkies and go and pick up, bags of wheat and the churns of milk, or the urns of milk, sorry, and take them off to the butter factory. And then later on they got some flat-top trucks and they would cart fuel in drums, or they'd cart wool down to Adelaide to the wool sales. And then Dad didn't actually want to stay at home. He wanted to be a doctor of all things, and he has the writing to do that. But he did. But the trouble was that my grandfather was an alcoholic, and he had drunk the business into bankruptcy. And so my nana actually asked Dad to stay home, and he agreed to stay home just for the first 3 or 4 years while they got the business back on to an even keel. But as with all these good stories, he never left. And I'm not sure how long ago he retired, maybe 8 or 10 years ago. I suppose. So he was instrumental in getting the road train specifications for the trucks that cart, you know, those really big loads up north across to Alice Springs and all up the Stuart Highway and so forth.
The old triple road trains.
Yeah, that's them. Yep, one of the guys that used to work for Dad, Jeff Ogilvie, he was the first guy that actually drove those triple road trains up the Stuart Highway, getting all the specifications for the brakes and all that sort of stuff to what they needed to know, how to pull up quickly or when they were empty or when they were full, and what type of structures they needed inside the tanks to, you know, the welding and the thickness of the tanks to make sure they didn't crack and so forth while they were on those roads, because there's no bitumen roads there then. It was all pretty potholy and red dust, red soil and dust and all that. So they were fairly fairly rugged times.
Yeah. Hey, what was life like for a young girl in, you know, that dot of a town of Oruro? And tell us, you know, some days you'd wander off to school and your mum would think you'd headed off to school, but something else happened. Your old man swung by, and where did you go?
Yeah, so we would Dad would come past school, and he would just, yeah, you'd hear the beep of the air horn or whatever was, however he was coming to get me, and I'd just grab my bag and climb up into the truck, and we'd sort of head off. We'd go, you know, up through Cooper Petey, Marlebore, Minterby, onto Alice Springs and out to Warburton out in the west. Other times we might go out a different track all the way up to or out to Moomba. We used to have a run that went up to Moomba and the gas fields up there. So it didn't really matter where we went, just as long as I was sitting in the truck and we were singing songs and Dad was, you know, arguing my mate. We used to have lots of good fun times. At one particular time, I remember I'd obviously been just given a reasonably good lecture about sharing with my brother, my little baby brother, and I wasn't particularly good at sharing, so Mum had obviously given me a lecture. Anyway, Dad, we weren't allowed to have sugar as a kid. No sugar. I do not have a filling in my head because my mum has never let me have sugar. And so Dad was drinking a Coke because that was how he managed to get through the really long journeys. And I said to Dad, well, now, come on, John, you need to share that Coke. So bit of a cheeky little girl.
Well, we'll find out whether anything's changed or not. Tell our listeners, What is a Gillaroo and why did you want to become a Gillaroo?
Well, Gillaroo is probably a bit of a fancy name for a farmhand these days. There is a little bit of difference between a farmhand or a station hand. But I don't think that Gillaroo would actually be politically correct these days, I suppose, because, you know,
yeah,
we're all the same. But a station hand or a Gillaroo, Jackaroo, is what they used to be known back in the good old days. Jackaroo was jack of all trades, you know, they'd get around and that sort of included, you know, mustering stock, fencing, pulling windmills, making sure the waters were all right for the cattle or for the sheep, you know, those types of things. So a jack of all trades that it was on a station that had to do all sorts of station work and understand the stock side of things as well as the mechanics and that. And a farmhand probably isn't too much different. So, you know, we're in a lot smaller, more intensive type areas. And so, you know, you've still got to know how to check waters and pumps and mechanics and stock. But down here, you know, we've got massive big machinery now. So it runs off computers with harvesting, you know, all the grains, and the boom sprays are all computerized and auto steer and all this sort of stuff. So you really have to be an all round.
So, Fleur, what was the appeal of becoming a farmer?
Oh, look, probably for me back then was when I just rebelled against everything. And it was so unusual for a woman or a girl wanting to go work on the land. And that was just pushing the boundaries, as I did in every aspect of my life, and I still do mostly. It was something that nobody else really did, and certainly nobody at the boarding school that I was at ever considered doing, because that was completely unladylike. That suited me pretty well. I guess that was the really big pull. But I had always loved open spaces. I'd always loved stock. I'd always really reveled in being outside and being in the freedom. And I guess that goes with that whole personality of not liking to being told what to do and, you know, that sort of thing that I've got. So, you know, the freedom of working on the is a huge pull for me. And it's always different. You know, every day is different. You get to get up and see the sunrise and you'll still see the sunset. And in between all of that, you know, maybe you've gone around and checked all your sheep, or you've put a crop in that day, or whatever. I don't know. Every day is different. I don't even know how to explain it. I just love it. And I love what I see. I love the beauty. Because even in a drought, when things are really horrible and, you know, not... whether there's dust storms or whatever, there's always some beauty somewhere, and that's what I love.
How do you go with the isolation of that, Fleur? Because that's a lot of land to cover by yourself.
I don't actually mind it. There was a long time ago, when I first moved out to the farm, when living over here, I used to spend a lot of time on the telephone, and that was when telephones were like connected to the wall, and we had no choice but to stay where we were. So I did used to spend a lot of time talking to my friends or to my family sort of after we're done. But a lot of the time, you know, you're really busy during the day, so you don't have an opportunity to get lonely. These days I'm probably fairly happy with the peacefulness of it all. And you know, this time you can take your phone with you. So if you're going for a drive around something, you can, you call somebody up or you take a photo and, you know, stick it up on social media, and then suddenly you've got all these comments. So, you know, you're never really alone these days. And of course I've got Jack, my puppy, who comes with me in most places. So yeah, it's never really that lonely anymore.
Yeah. Great modern technology. Hey, can we, if we wind the clock back to when you, let's go way back to 1996, right? You and your then husband bought a farm near Esperance in WA, and you lived in a donga without power or a toilet. What was life like when you bought that farm and you've moved into, and if you could explain what a donga is, that'd be handy. Was life challenging, or was it just part of the adventure?
Oh, look, I think totally part of the adventure because, you know, I didn't know any different. Yes, certainly I had I lived in a house, that a really nice house when I was a child and boarding school and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, we wanted to be farmers. We wanted to own a lot of land. We wanted to be successful in what we did. And I don't think that when you've got dreams, anything is too hard. You know, if you're reaching for that, nothing in this world comes easily. So when you're reaching for that goal that you have, you know, there wasn't anywhere else to live on that farm. We couldn't afford to put a house there. So, you know, we had to live on the farm. So that was that. There was no discussion really about any of it. The only thing that I really ever kicked up at, because you know, there was holes in the walls and the snakes and the mice would come in and I used to have moss growing in the windowsills. No matter how many times I used a screwdriver to get that out, it would always come back again. The thing that really annoyed me at one stage and I put my foot down at was we didn't have a fridge. So I was taking an esky and I could keep the milk cold for about, or not going off, not cold. I could keep it from not going off for about 3 days. And then, and I drink coffee and I have milk in my coffee. And if you want me to work as hard as what I was working, I need my coffee in the morning. So I put my foot down when about, I don't know, 3 or 4 months in, when I was sick and tired of this milk going off, I said, we need a fridge. So we got a gas fridge. And I remember, you know, just one of those little small half-size fridges. Yeah. And I had a tiny little freezer in it. And it was great. I had never been more grateful for a fridge or something to keep something cold with. So I was quite happy to have fresh milk and not have curdled milk or lumps in my coffee in the morning.
But you only had power for 3 hours of the day, didn't you?
Yeah, so it was gas. It ran off gas. It was a caravan fridge, so it ran off the gas. We had a gas stove and a gas fridge.
Unbelievable. Hey, you became a mother. Tell us, what was motherhood like for you in the very early years of your two children out in the remote regional part of WA?
It's a very blurry. That's probably the nicest way of putting it. I seem to remember a lot of projectile vomiting, screaming, and sleepless nights. They're the three things that I remember. My son was an incredible projectile vomiter. He used to be able to hit the TV cabinet from the couch.
Oh.
And because they didn't sleep, you know, I was really tired and just a lot of fog. I was still working on the farm and I'd just pick the kids up and take them with me when I went. But, yeah, a lot of days that I have no recollection of, you know, because you're just sort of wading through everything that you've got to do.
Yeah, and on top of that, you know, there was the projectile vomit and you're working on the land and you're raising two kids. You know, they had their own challenges, right? And they weren't sleeping, but they also had their own challenges. And in actual fact, I think from what we were talking about the other day, that is where your writing and storytelling evolved from when your kids were younger. Can you take us through how that came to pass?
Yeah, both of the kids had disabilities and, yeah, Rochelle has what they call dyspraxia, which is a breakdown in speech and gross motor skills, and she didn't speak until she went to, I think she might have been halfway through kindy or something when she finally managed to get 3 or 4 words strung together. So I taught her sign language. And then Hayden came along. There's only 13 months between the two of them. And I tell you what, living in this ATCO hut that was freezing cold in the middle of winter, and I would go to bed in tracky pants and a skivvy and a beanie, I still am in awe at the fact that I got pregnant twice within 13 months.
Yeah.
There is the tenacity or something there.
Something like that.
She had this disability that was diagnosed when she was 18 months old. And by that stage, I already had Hayden, and he was a really difficult child. But we didn't really know why. Like I said, he was great. He had a lot of colic, and he was uncomfortable, so he screamed a lot. And I'd said a couple of times, I think there's something else that's not quite right with this kid, but you know, I hadn't a normal child, so I wasn't sure. I did. This was my first, you know, I hadn't had any kids around me sort of at all ever, because I was the oldest of my family. And so, you know, these two little babies that came along, I hadn't had a lot to do with kids beforehand, so I didn't know. And then one day the speech pathologist that was working with Rochelle said to me, I think Hayden's got an intellectual disability. And of course that sent me into a tailspin. And that day I was down at the doctor's surgery, sort of like banging on the door to my GP going, can you please look at Hayden again? And so we got sent to a pediatrician in Esperance. It was a visiting pediatrician. And then he said, Barley's, I don't know. And he sent me to Perth. Right. So what came out of that was a diagnosis of Hayden was at high risk of autism, and that was, again, at 18 months, because at 18 months, that's that core time where they're supposed to be able to speak and have quite a few words, and when they don't, that's when people go to investigate why they're not speaking. So that was how we got to that point. We had two lots of assessments done on Hayden, one when he was about two, and then I think the other one was when he was in year three or four or something. And that second one was when he was actually diagnosed with autism. So as people that have got autistic kids would know, they don't have a great attention span. So I was trying to help Hayden with span by writing stories, kids' stories about how, you know, the pet dog had gone over and or the work dog had gone over and, you know, rounded up the pet lambs one afternoon or, you know, got them into the yards when they shouldn't have. Or so stuff that he knew. And that was really how I started writing again. I'd always written, but not, you know, not with any goal in mind, I suppose.
Wow. When, like, that sounds all incredibly difficult. When did you decide to add to the level of difficulty and decide to write a book and attempt to get it published? And how did that actually come to pass?
Well, you know, I think, like I said before, you've got a goal, you just sort of do things. And I actually didn't have any intentions of trying to become published. I just loved writing, and I had this storyline popping. I had been doing a writing course, that was where the children's books had sort of come into it, as well as, you know, Hayden. And my tutor had said to me about the children's books, he'd said, you know, I think you're hiding your life under a bushel. You should try and do something with these. And I sort of, knew that I wasn't going to get a lot of support from family members and so forth. So I sort of left it. And then this idea popped into my head one day about stock stealing in the Flinders Ranges. And I still quite in awe that idea arrived, because like I said, I don't remember a lot of those years because it was so blurry and so foggy with everything. And I just had to sit down and write, and my fingers were literally itchy until I had stopped and written. And I wrote a lot of that book longhand to begin with. I'd write in secret and when I'm shifting sheep and all those types of things. And it was a real escape for me, I suppose. You know, in 2008, which was the year before Red Dust was published, it was a horrific drought over here, and you know, so much so we had stock adjusted all over the place, and my ex-husband would, you know, be leaving at 3 o'clock in the morning, and he would, you know, do a 24-hour round trip without stopping to check on everything, and then come home, and you know, I would have been dealing with what had happened at home while he'd been away. So it was where you could go into a space that you could make it rain when you wanted to. You could stop kids from crying, or you could if that annoyed you. And I really liked that.
Yeah.
So it turned into an escape for you.
Yeah, it was a huge escape. And because there's no expectation either, you know, it was really easy. That if I look back now, people ask me if you've written 18, 19 books, you know, do you find it easy? Well, no, I don't. I actually find it incredibly hard these days. You know, back when I first wrote Red Dust, there was no expectation on me and I could just have fun. And that, the fun hasn't been lost, but it's certainly more of an expectation. It is a business these days. So it's one of those, You know, it's one of those things you've really got to balance and remind yourself there is fun to be had.
You mentioned earlier that you didn't actually set out to publish or sell books. How did Red Dust come to be published?
Yeah. I think I just getting encouraged from a lot of my friends. You know, I would let them read what I had written and they were loving what I had written and they said, well, I'd like to read this in a book. And so I sort of found there's, I don't know if it's still around or if there is an e-version of it or what, but the Queensland Centre were had a massive resource of the writer's marketplace. Was every writing competition that there were a publisher, newspaper publisher, yeah, everything that you would need to know about the publishing world was in that book. And I had, that was just a dog-eared, crinkled copy, read it, and then I'd work out where I was going to send the manuscripts to and all that. And then not long after the kids had started at primary school, I suppose it was, 2007, I think, I saw that Friday Pitch Day had started with Alan Unwin, and Louise Thurtell was in charge of that. She was a bit of a maverick. You know, nobody had, across all of the publishing industry, had looked at anything like this before. The slush pile was, you know, one of those big A4 yellow envelopes that you would stick in the mail that you'd never see again other than to get a rejection slip back saying, you know, you don't bother sending it in again type thing. But this was online, it was through email, and you could only send it in on Fridays. So that was what I did. I sent the first chapter and synopsis of Red Dust in, and she came back and said, oh, look, your writing's really strong and commercial, but it's not what we're looking for. And then I waited, I don't know, 2 or 3 weeks or 4 weeks or something, and sent three chapters this time and the synopsis back in with an email offering to pay for her feedback, which and to reject you, and that would have been a really big one. But, yeah, we got through, and Louise saw there were good bones. I was very green and, you know, everything needed a lot of work, but she saw good bones in the book. And this one day I got a phone call from her, and I'd been in the sheet yards for about 6 weeks, and I had dirty clothes and a rambling garden and no housework done for about all of that time. And she rang up and said, hi, it's Louise. And I said, I'm thinking, who the hell's Louise? I don't know any Louises. And then she said, from Alan, and I want to make you an offer on your book. And for some reason, as you can hear today, like, I've got verbal diarrhea. I love to talk.
Yeah.
And I just suddenly went all quiet and asked some really what I hoped were professional questions. And she said to me later, you are the most unexcited author I ever made an offer to. And I took a deep breath and typed out an email that said, oh, you didn't see me jumping on the bed after I hung up the phone. So that was it.
Beautiful, beautiful. So I don't know, what is it, 15, 16, 17 years later, you've sold over 650,000 copies of the books that you write. How has your writing changed over that time? And you said that you've, you know, you think back to that original book and it had great bones, and like, how has your writing changed and what have you learnt along the way about storytelling?
Oh, what have I learned along the way? I've learned along the way that I still push boundaries. I don't like to conform to genre writing. And
sounds like a common theme in your life.
Yeah, it is. It absolutely is. So storytelling, I guess, comes very naturally to me. I'm lucky like that because I come from a long line of storytellers. But what I've learned about publishing is it's a lot of luck, and it, I was the second one that was published after Rachel Treasure, which is why I have a reasonably good, solid base readership, for which I'm very grateful. But all it would have taken is for somebody else to put a manuscript in a week before me, and they decided to choose that instead of mine, and I wouldn't have had the career that I've had. So there is a lot of luck in publishing, in timing, and, you know, those types of things. So you've got to keep writing really fresh and authentic. And fresh, by fresh for me, that's pushing the boundaries. You know, I don't, life doesn't have happy endings. So there's not very many, there's always happy endings in my books, but not always. Not everybody comes out smelling of roses, or there's no romance type. Romance of the land or anything like that. When you read my books, you will find out what it is like to be a farmer, or, you know, so there's sort of, I guess that's pushing the boundaries a little bit. But certainly in Deception Creek, about three quarters of the way through, there's a incident there that everyone sort of gasped at, and my publishers, when they first read it, came back to me and they said, oh, Fleur, do you really think that that needs to happen? And I know you're going to say yes. And I said, yes, I am going to say yes, and no, I'm not changing it.
I'm really interested in the process of writing, because what I've read about how you write is really quite amazing, that the characters, well, you can probably tell it better than me, but the characters almost come to you and tell, well, this is who I am and this is how my story is going to unfold. Can you talk our audience through that process for you? Because it's really fascinating.
It probably sounds so weird. I get a bit embarrassed in talking about it because it is weird. I don't know, these characters run around in my mind, and I have a inkling about the way that they are going to go and how I think they should react and respond to challenges that I put them in. But yeah, a lot of the time they fight what I want them to do. I spend a lot of time in my subconscious as I'm writing these, so sometimes I don't realize what, and I'll have that one character should do this. And I guess, again, Deception Creek, if I can use an example, Emma in Deception Creek is supposed to be a really strong character, but she's actually a bit rocky at times, and she's divorced and she's trying to work out why her life hasn't gone quite according to plan. And I thought I could just load all of my divorce emotions on her. She would just react the way that I reacted, and, you know, she would be very easy to write. Well, that did not happen. She totally bucked the system, which maybe is me. Again, I'm not sure. But,
yeah.
She totally bucked the system and just didn't do what I wanted her to do. And her story ended up being really hard to write and very different to the way I'd envisioned.
So can you just talk us through that process in a bit more detail? Because to the uninitiated author, it just seems like a bizarre concept that you've come up with the character and yet they're not doing what you want them to do, but you're writing the book, Fleur. So how does that happen?
Well, if I knew, I'd be able to whip them all into line and tell them exactly what they should be doing when. But the trouble is, I don't know that. I'll have an idea. I will have an idea about what they should do at where. And sometimes that happens. But also, I can go back and write. I might write for 2 or 3 hours, and I'll read back over it, thinking that what I've written is crap. I always think that, you know, that's just everything I write is going to be crap. And then I'll suddenly go, oh, that's nowhere near as bad as what I thought it was. Oh, really? Did you write that? I don't remember writing that, but it had to be me because no one else has written it. So I don't actually know how those words end up on the page. And I'm sure, anyway, someone will come and lock me up one day, but it just sounds, I know it sounds weird, but that's just the way it is. And I think in a way that's, it's actually a good thing because you're totally in amongst the pages, you're totally in amongst the characters, and you're not going to get it, in inverted commas, out of character either. So you're not, yeah, so it's going to be real.
That's fascinating. It is fascinating. It's fascinating to get an insight into what's going on in your brain, Fleur, because like that, to hear that back, that is just, you know,
it sounds like you're still sleep deprived from 20 years ago.
There's a thing, I saw a thing up on Facebook, one of those memes up on Facebook that said about being inside a creative mind where there's like 5,296 tabs open and you don't know where the music's coming from. That's me.
That's you.
Right.
Right. Okay. Hey, tell us, you've been living on the land, running a farm, writing books, bringing up your kids on your own for many, many years. And you also decided that you needed to start up a not-for-profit and to help, you know, women and families in regional and rural areas when it came to domestic and family violence. Tell us a bit about that.
Right. So I lived in a relationship, one of my relationships that had domestic violence, and it wasn't physical, but it certainly was mental. And you know, everything that goes with that. You knew me when I came out of that relationship to where I am now. You wouldn't probably be able to believe I was the same person. So when I first came out of that relationship, I couldn't work out whether I was going to wear a jumper to blues because it was cold or hot sometimes. So I was I was in a pretty bad way. And I found that I went looking for services to help my kids and I when I left, and then they just went around. They were there, but they were really incredibly difficult to find. And what's so important about having services at people's fingertips when they are in a really, really horrible situation, if someone stood over them and belted them, or, you know, they've stormed out the door and that person snaps and they're brave for those couple of seconds, they need help right then, because that decision that they've made in those couple of seconds, they may not make that. If they can't get the help they need, then they may not make that decision again. They may not act on the decision that they've made. So I wanted to get all of these services in these country towns so they're available to men, women and children, to be able to get them all into one area on a website. All the graphics needed to be low res, so it loaded quickly in low, horrible internet areas, and they could just get what they wanted. So the icons would come up with, you know, just examples, crisis accommodation, everyday necessities, counselling, you know, these types of things. So, and so I took that idea to the Rural Women's Award, and I didn't win, but I came runner up for that. And that was where I thought, you know, I think this is too important not to do something with. So I did that. I put my own money into it and I got two towns up onto the website. And while I was doing that, I knew that I was going to come across areas and towns that didn't have counselling services in them. And knowing how important counselling was after the fact, that I thought, right, that's okay, we'll just put counsellors in these towns. And then I realised that that was just a silly idea, because not everyone's going to want to live at Marble Bar, not everyone's going to want to live at Esperance or Albany or wherever. So I thought, well, if we can put all of that online, so we've got counsellors through chat rooms on the website and perhaps on telephones, then, you know, we've got a chance of helping people the minute that they need it. And so I knew that I didn't have the money to expand to how I to do, so Peter was a mentor for a little while, and we went to Canberra. And what was so funny about that was the one meeting that I went to without Peter, meeting that we got the funding from. So we just under $3 million through months of being able to spend a lot of money to get the counselling services up and going, the online chat, and expand the towns to 16 towns. Now they've gone on and expanded from those 16 towns since with extra funding, which is fantastic. And it was always intended that it go nationwide, because when we started DV Assist, it wasn't there wasn't anything like this in Australia. It was really unique because we were focusing on the really different, the massive differences that we have in the country to people in the city. You know, we've got guns for one, the isolation, everybody's intertwined and interlinked. So it's really important that the counsellors understand those differences when they're offering advice.
Amazing. That really is amazing. And thank you for sharing that, Fleur, that you've been able to create this amazing service for people that are in need. One thing that I'd love to ask you, and when we talk to a lot of, we ask this question of many of our guests. So how do you deal with in your mind when, you know, that little voice on your left-hand shoulder says, oh, this is too hard, or I can't do this, or I don't have time, or I'm not good enough? How do you keep on doing what you do?
Well, I think I've run my life the way that I think I've early on in the piece, I was certainly naive enough to think that I could do anything, and that was certainly the way that my parents brought me up. But, you know, as you get older and you realise, or as you understand, come to understand the world, if anyone can, you know that that's not necessarily the case. And I guess, I don't know, I just get an idea and I think, well, that's what I'm going to do, so I do it. And I've tried to bring my kids up like that as well, you know. Hayden, you wouldn't have ever thought Hayden would have ever been able to become a pilot, but it has. And if you know, if you're naive enough to believe you can do something, you just do it. And I have little time for people that say they don't have time. If you have a dream and you, a goal, and that's what you, that is running around your body, and you dream about it every night, and it's and you think about it all the time, you will make time to do it. So I went and saw I saw Lisa Harvey, who used to be the leader of the opposition, the Liberal Party over here in WA. I went and heard her speak one day, and she said, say yes to everything and work out the logistics later. And that's how I've run my life for a long time.
Sounds like it.
That is amazing. All right. I've got I've got one more question for you. So tell us, Fleur, what is next on your to-do list? You've led this amazing life. You've worked absolutely your fingers to the bone, whether it be on the farm, raising the kids, you know, writing all of those amazing books. You've created DV Assist. What's next? What's next that you'd love to tick off?
Well, you know, there's always that big one that you want to, I don't know, fall in love and find somebody that's going to love you back and all of that. I guess there's that one. putting that one aside, I guess I've got a few things that I would like to tick off within the actual publishing world. You know, I've written these books, these same type of books for you know, a long time now, and I've got a few different things I'd like to try. You know, I know my characters that are reoccurring characters like the back of my hand, so it would be nice to go and meet some new ones. So there's a few things I'd like to try there. I still am I still advocate very much on behalf of domestic violence or people that have experienced domestic violence, but also autism. I go and speak to people around the country. Well, when I could get out of WA, I'd go and speak to, you know, as speakers and just try and help. And I like if people come to me with enough of the same issues, and I can see that there is something that needs to be changed, well, then I'll very much do my best. You know, I've lobbied for certain aspects about the agricultural industry to change. I've same with women in agriculture. So I feel if I can see that there is something there that needs to be done, I'll take it up. But yeah, it's got to be something that I feel very, very strongly about. That's me. I don't know. I think the fact is I've just got a heart for helping people, and that's what I want to do. So I have no idea where that's going to lead me, really.
More things are going to be created. That's what it's going to lead to. And, you know, full credit to you. Setting up everything you've set up is quite extraordinary.
It is absolutely extraordinary. One of the things that I wanted to touch on there, you spoke about it first up, and that is about finding love. And you're all about helping people, right? How can we help you find love? So if someone out there is listening to this and they go, oh my goodness, Fleur sounds amazing. I need to get in contact with Fleur. How do they reach you, Fleur?
It's all of a sudden become a dating service.
It's not only a podcast, it's a dating service.
Oh, there you go. Yes, well, anyway, I think if they wanted to find me, they'd probably find me.
You're not wrong.
Reasonably easily found on the internet, I think.
Yes, you are. There is.
Well, I tell you what, they could do, Blake. They could buy Fleur's latest book,
Deception Creek. And hey, one more question about Deception Creek. There's a cult family in Deception Creek. What, any families you know, or?
No, that's totally a figment of my imagination. I just need to put out there that any character, what's that disclaimer that's in the front of every book? All of this is a work of fiction. There is nobody in there that you will know, anybody else will know. And if you think that I have created a character that reminds you of someone, all I know is I've done my job really, really well.
That is a beautiful thing. Hey, Fleur, you're an amazing storyteller, and thank you so much for telling us your story. It is absolutely inspiring, and, hey, can't wait till Deception Creek comes out. Nick's looking forward to reading it.
Absolutely.
And good luck with absolutely everything that you do next.
Lovely. Thank you so much.
Like, that was Fleur.
How amazing is Fleur? Like, from a kid growing up in the country with a family, that transport company, wanted to become a Jillaroo, went out, lived in the boondocks of Australia, but through some adversity and through this need to tell stories to her kids, was born this amazing career. And look at what she's done, 700,000 copies.
Yeah, it's incredible.
What I think is more incredible is the degree of difficulty that we were working under through that recording. There was about listeners through the modern, through Nick's amazing ability to edit, what he's been able to do is chop out the 15-second delay that was at our end and Fleur's end, and it was just an absolute nightmare to record. But she did an amazing job, and we really
She's a professional.
Her.
She's kept on churning through it, which was fantastic. If you love this episode and you want to hear more episodes of authors, check out episode 2, Dan Ziffer, who wrote a bunch of bankers.
Yep.
Episode 15, Nikki Greenberg, who is now a renowned children's author and illustrator. Sarah Bailey, who's an ad executive by day, best-selling crime writer by night. Declan Fay, comedy writer for Rove, Ronnie Cheng. Alison Pennington, episode 32, who's a political economist. The amazing world champion, multi-world champion, Emma Carney. And finally, episode 50, the last episode we released was Dean Karnazes, the ultra-marathon man who's released a ton of books as well.
Yeah. Have you ever thought about releasing a book?
Yes.
Have you?
Yeah.
When
it's
are you,
coming out soon.
What's it called? Yeah, good.
We get to the title last year. You can't judge a book by its cover. It's all about the contents. I might even have it unnamed.
What's it about? All right, that is it for episode 51. We've got to go. Nick's got to get and write that book. Thanks for listening, Doolanders.
Bye for now.
Hey, Doolanders. If you want to hear more inspiring stories and have this show grow to more and more listeners, do us a favour. Can you like, share, rate and review the Doolander podcast on wherever you get your podcast from?
Wherever good pods are cast.
That's where...